want you to imagine there's a famous science professor from a university here in Canada. And he has a YouTube channel with millions of followers because he's able to explain science in a way that everybody understands. But he's also doing like amazing research, and he's inventing all sorts of crazy stuff. And he's had multiple TED Talks. One of his TED Talks, he's developed a new antibiotic that actually kills viruses, right? So he's literally curing the common cold. And on another TED Talk, he outlines how farmers can increase the yield of their farmland by 100-fold. And so as they start implementing this, it looks like we can literally end world hunger because of this stuff that this scientist is developing and the research he's leading and all of that sort of thing. He's developed some mathematical models that can much more accurately predict extreme weather. And so, if hurricanes are going to land or tornadoes are going to come, they can evacuate people. And if floods are going to happen, they can evacuate people. And so he's saving lives from natural disasters. And all the while, he's talking on talk shows and his YouTube channel and all of this stuff, but he's talking about how, government officials and government bureaucracy, they're blocking his developments from being used and from being implemented, that there's all of this government red tape in the way. And so people keep asking, well, why don't you run for office? You've got all of these solutions to these problems. Why don't you get involved in politics? And he claims, no, I'm a scientist. I'm not a politician. But even as he's saying those things, he starts outlining ways that government could be streamlined and cleaned up as well. So imagine, his popularity is growing. He's an internationally renowned figure. And rumors start to come out that maybe he is going to run for office. And one day, as one of the political party's national conventions is starting, somebody sees him heading to the airport on a flight to that city. And Twitter explodes as people start talking about, Dr. So-and-so, he's going to the city, maybe he's going to the convention. And he arrives at the airport, and there's already a crowd of people, and they're chanting for him to run for office. And he gets a limo to the hotel where the convention is happening, and everybody's outside chanting for him to run for office. And they're they've got signs, "We support you, and we'll vote for you, and change the government, and save the world." And he gets out of the limo, and he walks into the hotel, and the crowd goes wild. He is going to take over the country. He is going to end hunger. He is going to end poverty. He's going to cure diseases. He's going to save the environment. And he's going to clean up the government all in his first term. That'd be pretty amazing, right? Well, that was the atmosphere in Israel at the end of 3 years of Jesus' ministry. Jesus was curing the sick. Jesus was feeding the hungry. Jesus had demonstrated power over nature and storms. He was turning people's hearts back to God. He was going to get rid of the hated Romans, wasn't he? That's what everybody thought. They wanted him to start a revolution and get rid of the Romans. People in Israel were looking for Jesus to end hunger, to cure diseases, to lead a revolution, to overturn the government. That's what they wanted from him. And with the exception of overturning the government, he had shown he could do every one of those things. He had fed thousands of people on 2 different occasions in 2 different places. He had cured all kinds of diseases and even cast out demons. He had calmed storms. He had walked in the water. Imagine what a general could do with those powers. Right? An army marches on its stomach. He could feed thousands of soldiers with 5 loaves of bread. If there was a storm coming, he could change the storm to fall on the enemy Romans instead of on his people. If anybody got wounded in a battle, he could heal them. If people got killed in battle, he could bring them back from the dead. Who could stop a general with that kind of power? Of course he's the Messiah. Of course God is with him. Of course, he's going to get rid of those pagan Romans who desecrated the temple and whose very presence in the Holy Land of God is an affront to Yahweh. Of course, he's going to do that. No wonder the people were nearly rioting when Jesus heads from Jericho towards Jerusalem. He was going to solve everything. We're going to take a look at how Luke describes Jesus' entry to Jerusalem. If you've been to church for long, you're familiar with this story. By way of context, Jesus is coming from Jericho, and in Jericho, he healed the blind man, Bartimaeus. And in Jericho is where Jesus encountered Zacchaeus, you know, the famous short tax collector, right? And he brought Zacchaeus to repentance and into the kingdom. And then as he's leaving Jericho, Jesus tells the parable of the 10 minas. You might be familiar with Matthew's version, the parable of the talents. But in Luke's gospel, Jesus tells the parable again a little differently. And Jesus tells the parable of 10 minas in which he begins, "A man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king, and then to return implicitly in his new authority as king to the land that he came from." So that's our context in Luke. Oops, sorry. We're going to read from Luke 19, verses 28 to 42. If you don't have a Bible and you'd like one, get your hands up nice and high. Our ushers have already handed a couple out, but if you'd like to read along and you don't have a Bible, they will get one to you. Excuse me, I've had a tickle in my throat for a couple days. Page 743 in the church Bibles. Luke chapter 19, verses 28 to 42. After Jesus had said this, and what was it that he just said? He just told the parable of the 10 minas, where the master goes away and he leaves the money with his different servants. And the first servant invests it and gets a massive return. The second servant invests it, gets a good return. And the last servant just buries it. So after Jesus had said this, he went on ahead from Jericho, going to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethpage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' tell him, 'The Lord needs it.' Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' They replied, 'The Lord needs it.' They brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives towards Jerusalem, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles that they had seen. They said, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' Oh, some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' 'I tell you,' he replied, 'if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out.' As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, 'If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes.'" Jesus goes on then to predict that their enemies would come and surround the city, lay siege to it, destroy it, and not even leave one stone on top of another. What's happening in this text? We're going to go a little bit more in depth into the text and the whole narrative at once before we get into kind of what it means, which will be a little bit briefer. So as I mentioned, after he said this at the very beginning, he's telling the parable of the 10 minas. At the beginning is something that, you know, we tend to take for granted, but in the first century would have been really significant. A man of noble birth goes away to be proclaimed king before he returns home. Now, under the Roman Empire, there were governors in different places, but there were a few people whom the Roman Empire named to be king or queen. You've heard of Cleopatra. She was named queen of Egypt and actually ruled over a massive realm. King Herod. There were a couple of King Herods. They had to be named king by the Roman Empire. So there was this historical precedent of important people who are a governor, or in the case of Herod, he was called a tetrarch, of these people going to Rome and actually being promoted to the point where they are now then king over the region that they administer. So the people who hear this story are thinking of Herod. But the way Luke describes this narrative and lays this narrative out, he's actually talking about, Jesus is actually talking about himself. And so if you jump from, you know, the parable of the 10 minas, and this man goes to be proclaimed king, then in verse 38, what are the people chanting as Jesus approaches Jerusalem? Blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. So a few verses later, here's the crowd proclaiming Jesus king. So Luke is doing this amazing job connecting the parable that Jesus just told to the events that then unfold on that Palm Sunday. And Luke wants us to see this connection. We often don't see the connection because we have chapter breaks and verses and little heading breaks. And we tend not to read the entire narrative as one piece. But when you read it all through carefully, suddenly you start to see that Luke is weaving the parable of the 10 minas through Jesus' triumphal entry. Just like in the parable, people have different responses to this man who goes away to be proclaimed king. And as the narrative in Luke unfolds, we see people have the same responses to Jesus who's being proclaimed king. In the parable, when the man goes away, the people where he's from, they send a delegation to object and say, no, we don't want him proclaimed king. And then when he is proclaimed king, these people are his enemies and he has them killed. Some people misunderstand, right? The third servant, he misunderstands his master, and so he just buries the money he's given, and yet others respond positively. So some object to him being proclaimed king, some obey the king, and others misunderstand the king and miss their opportunity. The third servant who buries his treasure misses the opportunity he was given. So, in the text, Jesus showed tremendous courage to enter Jerusalem this way because there is a bounty out for his arrest. The Gospel of John tells us in chapter 11 that the officials were offering a significant prize to anybody who could help them arrest Jesus. So for Jesus to openly enter Jerusalem was pretty gutsy on his part. And as he approaches, we're told he passes through a couple small towns, Bethany and Bethpage. Bethany was significant. It was in Bethany that Lazarus lived with his sisters, Mary and Martha. And it was in Bethany that actually they stopped there on their journey from Jericho. And John's gospel tells us it was here that Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. And it was in the midst of this miracle that the people have seen that all of this chanting is coming about, blessed be the king. He just brought back Lazarus from the dead, who'd been dead for several days. So Jesus sends two anonymous disciples, ahead to one of these two little villages to fetch a donkey, a donkey colt, so like a baby donkey. Not baby, but young donkey. Now, it's unclear, actually. It's funny because people have really struggled with this because it kind of looks like they're carjacking this donkey, right? Like, kind of looks like they're stealing it. And so some commentators say, you know, Jesus was known here, so it's possible that he had arranged this beforehand with the donkey's owners. And actually, it's plural owners, which means that it was probably a very poor community that they all owned this donkey together. So maybe that's why it was okay to kind of, you know, loan the donkey out to Jesus. Or it could be that Jesus had his divine foresight at work here, because a few verses later, he uses his prophetic foresight to prophesy about Jerusalem being destroyed. So we really, the gospel doesn't answer that question, but whatever we know is that he wasn't stealing the donkey. He had permission, but maybe that permission was given after the fact. We're not sure. But at the end of the narrative, Jesus uses his prophetic foresight to describe the destruction of Jerusalem that happened in AD 70, about 40 years after his crucifixion, and he describes it pretty accurately. Now, we don't know which two disciples Jesus sent, but we do know they were obedient. They're anonymous. It doesn't say he sent, you know, Peter and John. It doesn't say he sent Andrew and James. Just sent two disciples. These two disciples are famous. We've known about them for 2,000 years. We, you know, celebrate them and talk about them every year on Palm Sunday. We have no idea who they were. We just know that they were obedient. And that's what Jesus is looking for in his disciples. Not that you want to be famous, not that you want everybody to know who you are, but that you'll be obedient. And you may then drift into obscurity, but your obedience will be remembered. We're told the colt had never been ridden. Why is that significant? Well, according to Old Testament law, if you were going to use an animal for a sacred purpose, like when David had the ark brought back to Jerusalem and it was drawn on a wagon pulled by two oxen, the oxen had to be oxen that had never been yoked before, right? They could never have been used for a different purpose. And so the fact that the donkey had never been ridden, meant that it could be used for the sacred purpose of the Messiah being revealed and entering Jerusalem. So this is why it's significant that it could be used for a sacred religious purpose. Notice Luke's description that it was the disciples who put Jesus on the donkey. This is an image of enthronement. This is not Jesus saying, all right, bring that donkey here. Here we go. I'm going to... No, it was the disciples enthroning Jesus on the donkey rather than him mounting himself. And donkeys were a sign, an animal of peace. When the Romans entered someplace or when a general or a king entered as a conquering king, they would enter riding on a horse, a war horse. Riding in on a donkey, the donkey was the pilgrim's animal. It was the humble animal. So although it is a kingly image, it is a peaceful image. The people lay their coats on the road, which is significant because in the Old Testament, in 2 Kings, King Jehu, he was a general, and he was anointed king of Israel. And he met with a prophet, I think it was Elisha, and Elisha anoints him in secret. And when Elisha leaves, his soldiers, his commanders are like, what did the crazy guy say to you? Literally, right? Like if you read the text in 2 Kings, what did that crazy old guy say? He's like, oh, nothing important. He's like, No. You don't get to pull that. Crazy prophets don't come talk to you in secret about nothing important. What was it? And Jehu says, he anointed me king over Israel. And they all bow down and they take off their cloaks and they lay them on the steps in front of him for him to walk on like a red carpet. And so all of these images, maybe they're not familiar to us, but we're just a bunch of Canadian Gentiles, right? We live in the 21st century. First century Jews who know their Old Testament inside and out are like, oh, look at that, look at that, look at that, look at that. All of these symbols and images were drawing from the Old Testament about kingly events. And so people were seeing this and they were joining in with the kingly symbolism as Jesus comes to Jerusalem. And as Jesus crosses over the Mount of Olives and he starts to descend towards Jerusalem, the people start chanting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. That guy on the donkey is the King coming in the name of the Lord." How do you think Herod, the king, felt about that? How do you think Pilate, the governor under Roman power, felt about, here comes the King? A little bit of tension. In the Old Testament, again, kingly images. King David, when his son Absalom started a coup and started a revolution, King David fled up the Mount of Olives out of Jerusalem, weeping as he went up the Mount of Olives, right? He was fleeing Jerusalem. Now Jesus is descending the Mount of Olives to start a revolution. So the Mount of Olives, actually, even in David's day, so like a good 1,000 years before Jesus, even in David's day, the Mount of Olives was already a sacred place and a place of worship. And it's named in the Old Testament as this is where David fled from Absalom, and he fled weeping up the mountain. And so here we have a king in the line of David coming back down that same mountain that David had to flee. Zechariah, the prophet, so a good 500-600 years before Jesus, Zechariah chapter 14 has a lengthy description and prediction that it will be on the Mount of Olives that God's Messiah would be revealed. So the Mount of Olives isn't just like, driving up and down the Hanlon. No, the Mount of Olives has religious significance. The Mount of Olives is a sacred place. So the location, the actions, the characters involved, the donkey, right, all point to a kingly Messiah in the line of David finally coming 1,000 years after David had to flee the city, finally coming to set things right, and the crowd goes wild. The Pharisees, the religious leaders, they were offended. And to be honest, they were terrified. Now, some of the Pharisees actually did follow Jesus. We know, Nicodemus was a Pharisee. And in John 3:16 is a verse told to Nicodemus. Some of the Pharisees followed Jesus, but often they had to do it in secret because of political ramifications. But many of the Pharisees, the majority of the Pharisees, here, they're offended. They're telling Jesus, Jesus, you got to cut this out. They're not going to listen to us, but what are you doing? You need to silence the people. They had three reasons why Jesus needed to silence the people. First, the people were too enthusiastic for Passover. Passover is a sacred festival. It's an important religious festival. It's what we remember when God rescued us from Egypt. Again, another significant Exodus image about here comes Jesus to rescue us from slavery to the Romans, just at Passover time when God rescued us from slavery in Egypt. But they're too enthusiastic for a sacred holiday. Come on, get with it. You don't play that kind of music in church. The Pharisees also, they didn't want Jesus proclaimed Messiah. Because they knew Messiah was political. They didn't want Jesus proclaimed Messiah. They weren't sure about him yet. They were actually pretty skeptical of him. And third, they were terrified the Romans would respond. Around the time that Jesus was little, maybe about 10 years old or so, there was a guy who tried to lead from Galilee who tried to lead a revolution against the Romans. And they went in and the Romans crushed the revolution, slaughtered people in the town, crucified people along the highway from that city to Jerusalem for like 100 miles. They crucified people along the road. So this was in Jesus' lifetime that there were other people who tried to start revolts. And when the Romans respond, it's ugly. So the Pharisees were legitimately scared, like, dude, don't provoke the Romans. Okay, we'd rather not all get crucified along this road. Thank you very much. But Jesus tells him, he responds, he says, you know what? This kind of praise is unavoidable. He said, if I tell the people to be quiet, the very rocks themselves, nature itself, would cry out in praise of me. And so this then, the next part is something that only Luke shares with us. The other Gospels don't include. And it's a stark contrast to the celebration that's going on. Jesus wept over Jerusalem as he starts to come down the hill. And he sees the city laid out before him. And all the people are cheering for him. He bursts into wailing tears. He wept over Jerusalem, knowing how little their enthusiasm was worth. He knew within a week these same people would be chanting for his death, and that the very Romans that they're afraid would respond would be reluctantly responding by scourging him and crucifying him. And he weeps over Jerusalem. He doesn't weep for himself. He doesn't see Jerusalem and weep because he knows he's going to be crucified. He sees Jerusalem. He knows that they're going to crucify him. And he weeps for them. He says, if only you knew what would actually bring you peace. You think a military general is what's going to bring you peace right now. You have no idea what really will bring you peace. You are alienated from God. You are God's people. You have the temple of worship of Yahweh, and you are alienated from God. You don't even know it. You don't even know what's going to bring you reconciliation with God. And so he weeps and wails. This is not just like a little trickle tear. The word used in Greek is for wailing, like grief when somebody dies. And so Luke presents this stark contrast of in the midst of this celebratory crowd, the intense sorrow in Jesus. And Jesus predicts the siege of Jerusalem. As I mentioned, it happened in AD 70. The Romans surrounded it. They put up some wooden siege works. The Jews burned them down. And so they set up earth and stone siege works around Jerusalem. They destroyed the city. They slaughtered everybody. They leveled the city to the ground. So what does this mean, right? If you've been in church for long, for years, if you went to Sunday school, you know the story of Palm Sunday, right? Our kids who are waving palm branches will remember when they're adults. That's what happened. What does it mean, right? Why is this significant? What are we to make of this? All four Gospels, as I mentioned, describe Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. Luke actually skips the real entry. He stops on the Mount of Olives, and the next thing we see, Jesus is in the temple. But each of the Gospel writers has their own particular slant on Jesus' entry on Palm Sunday. And Luke ties his narrative to that of King David in the Old Testament. And he also ties it to the parable Jesus tells of the 10 minas. And when I say that he's tying it together, I'm saying that Jesus did tell that parable at that time, and David really did do that in the Old Testament. Luke is seeing these connections and kind of laying them out for us so that we can see what Jesus was doing. And each of the gospel writers kind of highlights different parts because they all have a different audience in mind. But Luke ties his narrative to King David and the parable of the 10 minas that Jesus had just told. And like in the people in the parable, the people in Luke's narrative of Jesus' entry, Luke kind of connects the dots for us that the people respond to Jesus the same way that the people in the parable respond to the man of noble birth who goes away and is appointed king. The three responses to Jesus that we see. First, we see obedience, right? We see those two disciples who are told to do something really weird. Jesus has been in Jericho for a while. How has he arranged this? He says, yeah, okay, go into the village. When you go in, you're going to look to your right. You're going to see this building. You're going to see a little donkey. Hasn't been ridden. You're going to... How does Jesus know? You know, okay, off they go. He was right. Look at it. Okay, but like, we're about to take somebody else's donkey. What do we do? Well, Jesus told us, if anybody asks, is what he's saying. All right, start untying it. People come. Hey, what are you doing with our donkey? The Lord has need of it. Okay. It worked. All right, let's take the donkey back to Jesus. Has Jesus ever asked you to do something and you're like, that's not going to work? What are you talking about? Right? But the amazing thing is, when you obey, it worked. You know? Sarah shared with us in our prayer time. She woke up in the middle of the night with a verse on her mind. Jesus was saying, you need to share this with your neighbor. Oh, it's not going to work. She obeyed. We haven't seen fruit of that yet, but maybe we will. Who knows, right? Maybe it won't be till we get to heaven. And your neighbor's going to be saying, I remember there was this time where we were walking to school, and you shared this verse with me, and I couldn't believe. Sarah may never know. But when Jesus asks you to do something, if you are his follower, it may not make sense. But if you obey, it'll be remarkable how well it turns out. That's the first response. The second response is objection. And I think as religious people, as good church people, we're very quick to kind of vilify the Pharisees and kind of distance ourselves from them. But they were the good church people of their day. And so we need to make sure as church people, as religious people, that we're never too quick to dismiss the Pharisees as the guys in the black hats that are bad, because, to be honest, they're often written for us to see, right, and to be careful. The Pharisees object. This is improper. The Pharisees object. You can't be the Messiah. You might be a good teacher. You might be a very nice man. You might be doing really good social justice ministry, but you're not the Messiah. So we need to be careful. They object. And they're also afraid of, what will people think? What will the authorities think? If we proclaim you Messiah, if we say you're the king, other people are going to get mad. She's not here, so I can name her and she won't know. Amy is working in the public school board. And it's interesting, as I talk with her, our culture is increasingly secular. And I know that Amy is having opportunities to get more involved with the union for occasional teachers, which is a really awesome opportunity for a Christian to have. But one of the struggles that I know I would have in that position is that if I proclaim my faith and that Jesus is the Messiah, I'm going to tick off these other people who don't want him to be Messiah. And what do you do when you say Jesus is the Messiah, and some people might respond, some people in authority might respond in anger, right? That's a risky proposition that many of you face in your workplace, right? If you work at the university is a very secular place. Can you be a bold Christian in the university and risk the administration coming down on you? What about in your workplace? What if you work in government? Wherever it might be, right? So lots of people object to Jesus. They don't want him to be their master. And they are like the delegation of people in the parable who are sent after the king and say, hey, whoa, 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 emperor, don't make this guy king. We don't want him king, but he's made king anyway. And then they are his enemy. Third is misunderstanding. You know, the people in the crowd that day who were shouting Hosanna and waving the palm branches and laying their coats down for the Messiah completely misunderstood Jesus. And because they misunderstood him, they completely missed their opportunity. Like the third servant in the parable who takes the money entrusted to him to invest and produce more, and in his faithfulness be given more opportunity, he buries it because he misunderstands the master. And how many of us are excited about Jesus? And, you know, we go to church and we sing the exciting songs, and isn't Jesus awesome? And we're so excited about the way that he's curing disease and he's feeding the hungry, or the church is doing these things, and we misunderstand the nature of who Jesus is. And even for all of our enthusiastic participation, we bury the gospel that he's given us. We miss our opportunity to produce fruit. And when we face him on the day of judgment, he's going to be like, "So what did you do?" If you misunderstand Jesus, you are missing your opportunity. And it doesn't matter how enthusiastic you might be about him being the king who's going to end poverty, or the king who's going to change the government, or fix the school system, or fix, you know, health care, or whatever those things might be. Those things are good, and Israel needed them in that day, and we need them today, but that isn't why Jesus came. They may be things his people do, but that's not why Jesus came. And when we misunderstand Jesus, we miss our opportunity and are headed for destruction. Jesus was clearly entering Jerusalem as a king, but as a misunderstood king. Even the 12 disciples who had been traveling with him for years, they misunderstood what he was doing, right? We spoke in the Lord's Prayer series that we just finished about the kingdom of God being the authority of God, and that kingship means authority. And that in the Lord's Prayer, "Let your kingdom come," means submitting to and respecting the authority of God to rule in our world, but also in our hearts. Jesus here is submitting to the authority of God the Father as he goes to Jerusalem, knowing he's going to be crucified. He's about to be elevated in his authority, made, proclaimed king by God in the resurrection, right? He's given the name above all names, so that every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So Jesus is going to Jerusalem to be proclaimed king by God, but not in the way that anybody would have guessed. His kingdom is not of this world, he tells Pilate. His authority, his rule, are not like the authority and rule that we see in the world around us. And so the people misunderstand his mission, and sometimes we still do today. The crowd cannot understand the nature of Jesus' kingship until after the cross. Even Peter didn't get it until after the cross and after the resurrection. The people of Israel, including the disciples, they want Jesus to save them from their problems. They want Jesus to save them from hunger and sickness. They want Jesus to save them from the problems of Roman rule, of corrupt government, of harsh government. But what Jesus actually came to save them from is so much bigger. He actually came to save them from the biggest issue, which is our alienation from God because of our sin and rebellion. Verse 38, the people are chanting, "You know, blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." Luke is a masterful writer, because if you think back to Christmas, in Luke's gospel, what do the angels say? "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men on whom God's favor rests." So he's bookending Jesus' earthly ministry with the angels saying, "Peace on earth, peace to men." And then at the end, the people are saying, "Peace in heaven." What does peace on earth and peace in heaven look like? Being reconciled to God. Jesus' kingship has to do with conquering sin and bringing peace to heaven and earth, not just Israel. And not just Guelph, and not just Canada, and not just your household. Luke hints at this with the words of the angel in chapter 2, "Peace on earth." Here, verse 38, "Peace in heaven." But for us to be able to see, it takes hindsight. And so the people that day, they didn't get it at all. They completely lack understanding, and it's going to have deadly consequences for everybody involved. Jesus in a week, Jerusalem in 40 years, and so Jesus weeps over the city. And as we saw last week with his full humanity, here again we see Jesus weeping, emotions, and humanity. So why does this matter, and how do we apply it? As you've probably guessed as I've been talking about, still today people have a range of responses to Jesus. Some people obey Jesus. Some people object to Jesus. And some people completely misunderstand Jesus. Some people go where he tells them to go. Some people do what he tells them to do. even if they don't always understand in the moment. Some people object to Jesus. They say, hey, he was a nice man, he was a great teacher, he was a good moral example, but he wasn't God. Oh, the resurrection, you know, that was added later by the church. You know, we know that didn't really happen. You know, let's all just love each other like Jesus did and be nice to each other. They object to Jesus because Jesus makes claims that you're not good enough and you can't be good enough. You need somebody else to help you be good enough. There is an offense buried in the gospel that you're not good enough for heaven. And you can't solve it on your own. And other people misunderstand Jesus. They just want Jesus to solve their problems. They say the sinner's prayer, they go to church, and then they're ultimately disappointed because their problems aren't fixed. They're still poor, or they're still hungry, or they still have broken family relationships, or they can't get the job they want, or their family isn't turning out the way they want. You know, I remember many years ago, there was a couple that came with their teenage son, and they said, I was talking with them, and they didn't know the Lord, and I said, why are you coming? They said, because all of the Christian kids we see, they honor their father and mother. They're good kids, and so we want you to fix our kid. That's not how it works. Right? So many of us just want Jesus to solve our problems. And we only submit to him to the extent that, you know, I want you to solve my problems, and when you don't, I walk away. I turn my back. I break fellowship with Christians. I didn't have the experience I was looking for. I didn't have the results I was looking for. People were hard to get along with in the church. They, you know, when Jesus didn't start a revolution, the people of Israel turned on him in a week, shouting for him to be crucified. Some people want Jesus to solve their problems, but Jesus wants to reconcile us to God. The result of that is many of our problems are solved, but not all of them, but they will be when he returns. Some people want Jesus to fix their poverty problems, their hunger problems, their health problems, their kids' problems. They want Jesus to provide for them whatever it is that they're dreaming of. And that isn't why Jesus came. These are all things Jesus has the power to do, and in his ministry on earth, he did these things for many people, but not for all. There were still poor people in Israel. There were still people who died. There were still widows who lost their sons that he didn't bring back from the dead. Jesus did these things to show that what he said was true, that he had the power and authority to be who he claimed he was going to be. They were not his goal. They were not his purpose. Jesus wants to solve our ultimate problem, the problem of being alienated from God because of our sinful rebellion against him. All of our other problems on this world flow out of that problem, including even environmental problems, right? All of creation groans in yearning for the children of God to be revealed because we screwed up the world and nature included, and that's the problem that Jesus wants to solve. So I'm going to ask you, how will you respond to Jesus? You've heard about him. I've been talking about him. You know about him. How are you going to respond to Jesus? Are you going to respond in obedience to follow him? Are you going to object to him and say, I don't want him to be the king of my life? Are you going to misunderstand him and say, oh, I love Jesus. He fixes all my problems. How are you going to respond to Jesus? Because 2 out of 3 of those responses are disastrous. This is not something that you really want to risk getting wrong. How are you going to respond to Jesus? We're coming to Easter, right? Easter is next week. Good Friday, the crucifixion of Jesus. This Friday, Easter is about the resurrection, which is what it's all about. The choice is yours to respond to Jesus, and let me urge you to accept him, to obey him, to make him the king of your life on his terms, not on your terms of you can be the king as long as you solve my problems. Amen.
Let's stand together as we sing one more song.